Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alarm! Alarm! Welcome to We Have Ways to Make You Talk with me, Al Murray, James Holland, your Second World War podcast, Duno Jour. How are you, Jim?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, actually. And could that opening two words be more appropriate? I don't want to reveal what we're going to talk about yet, just yet,
because
build the anticipation. I'm good, thank you. I was touring around the country last week, so I was in Cambridge on Thursday and I was at Hay on Wye on Friday. It was all good fun. So yes, I just mustn't forget to mention is that I am finally doing a kind of sort of Sherwood Rangers Brothers in Arms tour of Normandy.
Yes, you are, aren't you?
The very end of April, beginning of May next year, so before all the hordes descend for Normandy 80th. So we're going to go and follow all the places for 5 days or whatever it is that the Sherwood Rangers were in Normandy, from their landing on Gold Beach all the way down to crossing of the Noireau and all that. So it's going to be great fun. And doing this for Trip Smiths. So if you Google Trip Smiths Brothers in Arms or Trip Smiths James Holland, up it will come. It'd be very nice to see anyone who fancies joining me on that. I don't think I'll be doing it again, to be honest.
Excellent.
Unique, once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yes.
Exactly. How are you? Time. How are you getting on?
I'm very well.
Progress being made on Arnhem.
Progress being made, and I had a very nice meeting with basically your designer, inherited your designer.
Yeah, the lovely Phil.
Phil, who's a listener. So hello, Phil.
Yeah, he's absolutely
Phil's
amazing.
Phil's a nice independent company member. Hello, Phil. How are you? Thanks for listening. we were talking about stuff, and he went, yeah, you talked about that on the podcast the other day. I thought, God, he really does listen to it. So, you know, discussions about Google Earth and stuff, or how to do a 1940s Google Earth is the sort of the thing to try and do. Anyway, We Have Ways Fest, by the way. Jim and I, at the end of last week, were wrestling with what the programme is going to be. We're
pretty much done now.
Almost done. For now, I mean, obviously.
A few tweaks and changes.
I'm still sort of mentally sifting, having read the Dudley Clark memoir, Rob Hutton's book, The Illusionist. I think the more I think about it, and the more I think about Cascade, which is the thing he did where he faked salt troop numbers and basically trickled this idea, this picture, out to the Germans. The more I think about that, and then, of course, Bodyguard is the sort of inheritor of that. The more I think about that, the more amazing it is that it actually ends up with Churchill going, why can't we do this? We've got 40,000 men in Crete. or Cyprus, or wherever it is. We've got 40,000 men in Cyprus. Why can't we do this? And basically, and Clark files it under, you know, hostile elements fooled or whatever. You know, because Churchill's been skim reading the intelligence briefs and has misunderstood.
Very funny. Well, I mean, to be fair, he does have a lot of reading matter every day.
Well, he has a lot. He's got a lot on his plate. There's something really funny about him fooling it. It's that convincingly painted a picture. It's such an interesting idea because why is it 1st Airborne and 6th Airborne Division? Well, because the idea is the British are going to form 7. And so you've...
Is that really so?
Yeah, except they don't. They can't. They haven't got the people. So you end up with
bonkers anyway.
Six,
they haven't got the means of delivering them, etc.
Exactly. Yeah, but you, there's 1 and 6, so you assume there's 2, 3, 4, 5, and then And then you name a battalion 7th Airborne Division for a bit, create the impression that there are seven. I mean, it's simple, but if you're, you know, accepting that there's a fog of war,
yeah,
you sort of put these the idea that these sort of lurking shadows that you... Yeah. Clark's method is to make sure that all the intelligence and all the stories he offers the Germans, there's an out. So when it turns out to be wrong, they can go, oh, it was wrong all along. And, you know, that there's enough in what he offers them for them to go... Of course, there was something that contradicted that, which is, I think, the subtlety and ingenuity of that, because it sat with mincemeat alongside it, which Rob sort of thinks the problem with mincemeat is all terribly obvious. And the fact that mincemeat...
Well, you would agree with that, wouldn't you? I mean, it's hard to disagree, but also,
and of course, it's after the event, but the fact that mincemeat... Rumours get out about mincemeat
really quite...
Changed the
course of World War II.
Well, exactly, but rumours get out about it quite quickly. Montague tries to write a book about it quite quickly and succeeds, and then writes the movie, you know, it's involved in the movie and everything.
The fact that,
you know, there's a film about it, you know, only a decade later, so suggests that really it's not that important, is it? Because you've blown it. It's blown as an idea straight away. And I think that's really interesting. That's, you know, and it's a good story because it's sort of grisly and it shows Allied ruthlessness and all this sort of thing. Whereas... what Clark's doing, this very subtle thing of having guys in Istanbul and running the cheese, you know, running Levy, who's cheese, and running all the, you know, the fake contacts that he's got for Levy, and then being plugged into Double Cross. And I think there's a really amazing moment where Clark is basically taken to Bletchley and they go, yes, we've been paying attention to your work. They can see him. They can see what he's doing with Cascade in their signals, you know, in the German estimations of British strength. It's amazing. Absolutely.
But also he comes across, I think the other thing about him is that he's just a very, very attractive character. I mean,
because he's
clever and he's witty and he's vain and all these sort of things, which makes him just the most bit of a snob, all those sort of things, but impossible to dislike. In fact, actually, to really like rather a lot. And, you know, that makes him such a great character. He's such a great British sort of smart, clever, eccentric kind of character. Of which the stuff of which the, you know, victory in the war is made, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and also he's focused on making it look really easy. And obviously they all say his staff work is impeccable. Absolutely everything about how he gets it done, you know, it's completely thorough. He's working incredibly hard, but he's making it all look terribly
effortless.
Easy. You know, he's effortless. And I think that's also incredibly attractive. He's not doing this whole... You know, I'm working awfully hard, don't you get it? I mean, I love the sort of side stories that one of his secretaries realises that if they've invented loads of fake units, that means she can throw balls so they can have a... they can have the made-up battalion ball once a week if they want. And that makes it look credible. These units are socialising and all that sort of thing. It's really, really funny. It's really cool. Anyway.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it's a terrific book. I really think it's a terrific book. Yeah. And I hope it does really well for Rob. He absolutely deserves it.
Now, funnily enough, I was talking to a friend yesterday about Greyhound and how much he was in, you know, how much he was looking forward to Masters of the Air and how much he loved Greyhound. So... And then, which coincides with you having sent me this book to read.
Well, Well, I was suddenly thinking. I was just sort of, you know, I've gone down a bit of a non-book rabbit hole with looking into tribal class destroyers and this sort of life on the seas. And I was rereading bits of The Good Shepherd, also known as Greyhound, when I was finishing off this novel I've been doing. Finished, by the way.
Handed in,
which is exciting. I've done that last week. That led me to think, God, wouldn't it be, you know, we don't do enough Navy on this podcast. Just don't do enough. I was thinking, well, it would be good to do a really good convoy. You know, which convoy should we do? So I started sort of nosing around, and then I came across Peter Gretton, who has cropped up so many times, but kind of peripherally for me, not least when I was doing Malta all those years ago, because he won a DSO when he was commander of HMS Wolverine. Which is a destroyer, on Operation Pedestal. And so he keeps cropping up, and he ended up staying in the Navy post-war. And he's obviously tough as old boots and exactly the sort of, you know, I mean...
Fifth Sea Lord.
He was the kind
time
of character on which the success of the Royal Navy in the Second World War was founded, you know, kind of started the war in his late 20s, sort of, you know, early 30s by the end of it, got three DSOs, DSC to his name, all that kind of stuff. You know, he's right up there. And anyway, he wrote this very, very detailed account of one single convoy, which is absolutely not the most remarkable convoy at all, by any stretch of the imagination. Right. It's convoy HX231. So this is sailing from, and this is a fast convoy, in inverted commas, because it's not fast at all, going from, ultimately, Halifax and Nova Scotia all the way to Liverpool. In the end of March, beginning of April 1943. So at an absolute pivotal moment in the Battle of the Atlantic.
He turns up in the World at War. So he's in
right.
the Wolfpack.
Of course
episode
he does. Yes, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. If people remember that, he's the one of the Navy, Royal Navy voices. That, I mean, he's pure Royal Navy. You know, he's Dartmouth. He's as Royal Navy as you possibly could be.
Got a DSO 1936 for mounting a landing party in Haifa during one of the kind of Arab flare-ups in Palestine. Anyway, he wrote this incredibly detailed account, and it's utterly compelling because what he does, I think better than any other personal account I've got, is he explains everything. So he does it. There's no assumed knowledge whatsoever. He explains absolutely everything, why they're doing it. And what I think comes across so well, in a way that you don't even get really in the Good Shepherd / Greyhound. All the variables, the constant guesswork between the U-boat commanders and the escort commanders, you're constantly having to make calculated risks and decisions based on hunch and likelihood, second guessing. And it's the whole thing is the most astonishing cat and mouse.
And hoping that you know, you see something, you hope that everyone else has seen something. Have they seen it? What was it? You see, you hear a light, you see a thing, you don't hear a bang, so you don't think it's a, you know, and so on and so on. I mean, the way he sets out his stall is really interesting. I also chose Convoy HX231 selfishly because I was the escort commander and because I wanted to find out what really happened. Now,
amazing,
which makes
isn't it?
Now that is amazing because Ridley Scott, of course, about his Napoleon film, said, "What do you historians know? You weren't there. You don't know what happened." Here is a man who commanded a convoy, who's the escort commander, who's saying, "I wanted to find out what happened. I was there, and I don't know what happened." So the direct thing. It says, "I've been careful to write the narrative impersonally, and I trust objectively, and have been as ready to attribute blame as praise to my performance." Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating, and he says, "I want to introduce the reader to the human problems of life in a convoy escort and the merchant ships under its protection." It's
which he does with bells on.
Oh, it's incredible! I mean, it's incredible.
He really does come across the human problems, and what you also get is the thing that's most striking for me, and we should maybe talk about this when we get to the end of this. I think this will be two podcasts on this.
Yeah,
it is actually the importance of experience and naval skill and nous compared to inexperience. And you're seeing on this convoy, you're seeing both examples. And what is absolutely clear to me is that for all the skill of the escorts, the B-7 escort group that is beetling around, and the air power and all the rest of it that comes into play, and the support group that comes into play, etc., etc., what is absolutely patently clear is, had this been 1941 and Kretschmer and Preen and Shevka and Co.
They're all going to the bottom, yeah.
The U-boat involved simply don't have enough skill to be able to do what they need to do by this stage of the war.
Well, we'll get to the stage of the war in a moment. But just a couple of tiny insights that he put. Here's the thing about how a lot of the men are sleeping on deck, above deck.
I know, isn't that amazing?
I found that absolutely extraordinary.
Particularly from the Corvettes. Because no one wants to be torpedoed.
There were indeed men who, unable to stand the thought of being trapped below when off duty, were trying to get some rest in corners of the wet, cold upper decks. And this fear was one of the worst problems facing a captain. Of those men who refused to sleep below, many carried out their jobs efficiently, but others undoubtedly allowed their fears to affect the conduct of their duty. The captain would ask himself, should A, B or C be put ashore as unsuitable? To be reliable, the answer needed the qualities of a psychologist as well as the professional judgment of a seaman. I just think it had never occurred to me that people would do that. And now, and
yeah,
now
and it's happening a lot
out.
In the merchant ships as well, isn't it? In freighters. Yeah.
And of course you, do that. I mean, you know,
because the last thing you want to be is below the waterline when a torpedo hits.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You might get cold, you might get wet, you might get a flu, but you'll still be alive. That's the principle.
March 1943. In 1942 has been there's been a happy time in 1940. And then
yes, midsummer to autumn, yeah.
Yeah. And then
happy time for the U-boat cruise, I should add.
For you, yes, for the U-boat cruise. So, I mean, in 1942, it's 7,790,000 tons of shipping sunk.
Yes, I mean that's a huge amount, isn't it?
I don't know how you get your head around that amount.
Yeah.
Actually. And this is at the same time as torches in the planning, or torches having to happen. And we've talked about this before. How on earth do the Americans turn their economy around to the point where they can, you know, within a year and a bit of the war starting, they're invading North Africa. It's sort of bananas, really, isn't it? But they do it, and with those shipping losses as well.
Yes. So by the time of the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, there is a shipping crisis, and the shipping crisis is caused by a number of different things. The first one is the 7.79 million tons of shipping sunk in 1942. The second one is because of the vast and ever increasing global demand. You know, Soviet Union, nationalists in China, accelerating Pacific War. But one of the immediate short terms is the fact that the Tunisian campaign has gone on much longer than everyone thinks. So it's still having to be surprising. It's just upset all shipping plans. And because between April and 1942 and May 1943, the priority for US shipyards is building assault craft, which they don't have enough of, rather than freighters. So all of which adds up to a perfect storm of kind of not enough shipping, which means that one of the reasons why at Casablanca there's such an urgency to win the Battle of the Atlantic is to try and right this situation, you know, to help the situation. I mean, because obviously, if you know how much shipping is going to come across the Atlantic, then that makes future planning a hell of a lot easier.
I mean, Churchill basically, sums it up pithily, doesn't he? So the defeat of the U-boat is the prelude to all effective aggressive operations, because
he's absolutely bang on.
You've just illustrated, because Tunisia's gone on too long, you've got a pinch on shipping, and because there's a pinch on shipping, Tunisia's going on too long. I mean, these things are Mobius strips, aren't they? They come back on themselves. If you can't supply, you can't win, and if you can't win, it affects supply. You know, round the thing goes on itself, right?
Yeah. Which is you know, we've said it many times on this podcast that the Atlantic War, as Mark Milner calls it, and I think quite rightly, is as opposed to the Battle of the Atlantic, is it is the most strategically important campaign of the entire Second World War, because everything flows through it. And without it working properly, the Allies can't hope to kind of succeed in the way that they want to succeed. So it is absolutely vital. And you know, the sort of revisionist views on the kind of importance of the Battle of the Atlantic and or otherwise, and on the amount of shipping lost. I mean, overall, if you take the number of ships lost compared to the number of sailings, it's only 1.4% in the battle in the Atlantic. And it's certainly true that 85% of convoys get through unscathed. But that again is over the entire war. But a quarter of all British merchant vessels are sunk.
Well, tell that to the men sleeping on deck, because they don't want to be. You know,
correct. Exactly.
We come back round to that thing of, and we've talked about it. We talked about it when we were talking about bomber crews, about, you know, the 8th Air Force when they first start flying missions. How do you get people to do this? How on earth do you persuade people to do this? Full stop. And you do it by improving your training, improving your kit, gaining experience,
and improving the number of escorts.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean,
it isn't
so very, you know, being a merchant crewman, for example, it's not so very dissimilar from being on a, you know, Flying Fortress crew, because obviously you you know, the chances of you being sunk on an individual convoy are pretty small, you know, if you're one of 60 or one of 40. On the other hand, accumulatively, you know, your luck is, those odds are decreasing every time you go. And everyone knows that. And I think one of the things that must have been so debilitating for all the crews, whether they be on the escorts or whether they be particularly on the merchant vessels in the convoy, is the debilitating tension there must be. You know, there's U-boats around, but you know, and it's absolutely clear when U-boats are kind of hovering around you, like, you know, swarming around you like sharks, and you can't see them, and you don't know when it's going to be you, and you're just going to be on edge the whole time. I mean, it must have been absolutely horrendous. After Casablanca, they then have an Atlantic convoy conference in Washington on the first 12 days of March 1943, presided over by the legendary Admiral Ernest King, who, as we all know, is very much a Pacific First kind of guy, but various things agreed, you know, which is there's going to be a Northwest Atlantic Command, which will be under the commander of a Canadian, and they will, the rapidly growing and increasingly impressive Royal Canadian Navy will take the kind of lead on that. Also, plan to keep escort groups together far more possible, much more than had been the case. So what would tend to happen is you'd form an escort group, and you know, you might have The makeup of that escort group might change quite a lot over the course of 6 months. You know, come and go, ships refitted, another one comes in, another one goes out. And they, from now on, they decide they're going to really try and keep that group as a group so that you have the benefits of unit cohesion and mutual trust and all that kind of stuff, all of which makes perfect sense. Better training, of course. So you put in charge, you know, the escort group commander is someone like Peter Gretton, who has been there, done it, you know, been at Narvik, been at Mediterranean, been on transatlantic convoys already. You know, there's not much you can sort of teach him. And then, obviously, the other big thing, the big changes, is the increase in numbers of very long-range aircraft. And VLRs are very long-range. And then they're primarily B-24 Liberators that can fly for up to 16 hours at one time. And they're operating out of Newfoundland, out of Iceland, out of Northern Ireland as well, quite often taking 6 hours to get to the convoy. And it should also be said that the U-boats have moved away from the east coast of North America, of the American coast by this point, the Caribbean and North America, and have moved back to the mid-Atlantic, the mid-ocean, where there is still...
Well, to the air gap.
The air gap, exactly. But the air gap is closing. That's the point. But of course, the Allies, even at this point, just don't have enough VLRs to do what they want to do in the same way.
Well, and there's resistance within the British establishment about VLRs, isn't there? Harris isn't going to give up planes if he can possibly help it. There's a tiny bit of sort of inter-service digging from Gretton about, you know, about Harris's attitude to aircraft. If you can see that bomber war is obviously relying on materials from the war in the Atlantic, then which one comes first? I mean, it's not even a chicken and an egg, is it? It's if you want to win the bomber war, you're going to have to win the war in the Atlantic first.
And it goes back to your point that you always make very well, is that you're always operating 6 months ahead of where you want to be, and you know, the just aren't enough of these VLRs, and the VLRs, you know, Harris thinks they could be better used as well. I mean, what does he say? In the present case, it is inevitable that at no distant date the Admiralty will recognise that U-boats can effectively be dealt with only by attacking the sources of their manufacture. Well, you know, he's completely wrong about that.
Yeah, he's completely wrong.
You know, that is not the only way that you can effectively deal with no. U-boats. And in fact, that isn't the way they deal with it. The best way to deal with U-boats is to sink them out in the middle of the Atlantic, which is what they do. And actually, it's interesting.
So you got the Kriegsmarine's experience base.
You know, he's
as well.
Just completely wrong about that.
It's interesting seeing him. It's interesting. Gretton obviously feels the need to get that off his chest when he's talking about this, because you're right. He's absolutely right. Because again, if it comes down to the moral component, there's no better way than undermining the U-boat service than sinking lots of U-boats and making the crews think it's horrible and pointless. That has to be a factor too. In March, Bletchley can't read Enigma at this point, can it? Which I think is which is interesting. I mean,
I think Kriegsmarine, the B-Dienst, has cracked quite a lot of the Allied codes.
No, a long time ago. They've been nosing around in the British cipher since Norway. So they've done very, very well against. Okay, you know, if this is another battle, they're currently winning. Which I think, you know, there is no smooth graph of British code breaking. It's as you said about the destroyer war, it's cat and mouse, and there's been cat and mouse. The Germans don't know that they've been broken into up to this point, but they have been. But at this point, they have that advantage, don't they? I mean, it's simple as that.
Yeah, there is, but there is also absolutely no question the U-boats are really hurting Allied shipping in the first couple of months of 1943. So in first 10 days of March, 41 ships are sunk. I mean, that's four a day going down. Between the 11th to the 20th of March, 44 more. So by the 20th of March, 500,000 tons has been sunk already. I mean, that's insane numbers, isn't it? And then you've got Professor Lindemann, our old friend, Lord Charwell, who's Churchill's chief scientific advisor. And so saying, you know, in March 1943, he's going, we're consuming 750,000 tons more than we're importing. In 2 months, we could not meet our requirements if this has continued.
I've started to think of him as kind of like Churchill's Dominic Cummings. He's got, you know, he's an expert.
A big
on
round head and these sort of, yeah, those little sort of antenna coming up.
Sort of, and a sort of myth-busty attitude to everything. If only you did it differently, it would all be fine. Read my blog, Lindemann's blog, him and Solly Zuckerman. Anyway,
that's the situation. It's critical.
Yeah, he's right.
So it is. Well, I know, because I think I've been guilty a little bit in the past of sort of blithely sort of saying, no, it was all in the bag. You know, there's no. I mean, there is no question that the U-boats couldn't win in the Atlantic. I think from May 1941, but could they seriously hamper the Allied war effort? Absolutely, and there is no question that in March and April 1943, as we build up to that crucial month of May 1943, when suddenly all the kind of long changes and developments in the Atlantic War sort of come to fruition on the part of the Allies and start to go pear-shaped for the Germans. Up until that moment, it's super tense, super critical, and the amounts of shipping getting lost are just of a horrific nature. And it's still winter, and this is the point, because the most effective time for the U-boats is winter, where it's dark, and the days are short, and the weather is worse. Because the worse the weather is, the harder it is to read radar, harder it is to pick up on ASDIT, which is, you know, what we now know as sonar, because you've got waves and you've got other disturbances to the water, which can kind of cause different signals. You've got, you know, it's harder to spot conning towers in a you know, when you've got shadows of waves and all sorts of stuff, for all sorts of reasons. In the high summer, it's easier for the Allies, and in the winter and the spring, it's much, and the autumn, it's much tougher and much better for the U-boats. Yes, anyway,
I think that's a really interesting point, because you'd assume bad weather's bad weather's bad weather, and that makes, if you're operating at sea, it just makes it more difficult, full stop, whoever you are. But because the U-boats are relying on, you know, concealment. So being concealed, being harder to see, is a win operationally. You're automatically, if the weather's bad, that's good for you. Even though being able to attack is more difficult if you're a U-boat in bad weather,
certainly on the surface.
Yeah, on the surface, but you're safer, and yeah, and that in the end is the what you're after, isn't it, if you're a U-boat captain, is being able to remain concealed for the critical moments where you need to be. Because after all, there's this thing that they go at walking pace underwater, 16 knots on the surface if they can. It's the business of charging the batteries, making sure there's fresh air and all that sort of stuff for the crew. They're submersibles rather than, or they can submerge,
right,
but not...
They're not true
ocean-going
submarine.
Underwater vessels. You'd think that bad weather would create a level playing field of things being difficult for everybody, but actually it doesn't. It makes it harder for the escorts.
Yeah, substantially. Yeah. Yeah, and again, this is why Gretton's so good on all this stuff, because he explains why so so clearly. Maybe we should take a break, and then we should should we get on to
That's a good idea. Yeah,
the formation of convoys.
Let's do that. We'll be taking a brief break to form a convoy ourselves, and we will return in formation in a second.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Make You Talk. James and I have just set up a signal flare, and we're forming around the
Star shell,
and we're forming around the bearing that I've sent him.
Illuminating the construct how a convoy works.
Well,
vivid brightness.
It's a tricky thing, isn't it? Because if you pick a convoy out of a hat, none of the vessels are the same, or some of the vessels are the same. Maybe half a dozen of them are Liberty ships or whatever. How on earth do you you've got to go at the slowest person's pace. So you can have a destroyer that can do it. I don't know. Was it the tribals that can do 36 knots? We were talking about the old 26 knots that can really really cut about 36 knots. So can really cut about, really go some whatever. Because the thing full of grain, you know, or full of zinc or whatever that's at the back of the convoy can only do 6 knots or 4 knots or three or whatever. Oh, so obviously the destroyer speed is all about being able to encounter and engage U-boats anyway, or catch up with the convoy once it's done the encountering, engaging, you know, so it's not off on its own and all that sort of thing. You've merchant vessels of Norwegian merchant vessels, you've Dutch ones, probably American ones.
Yep, Swedish, American, British.
Crews from all over the world. Crews with different expectations of all sorts of things, haven't you? So right from the start, the simple thing of a convoy, the idea of a convoy. You know, you're herding cats, aren't you? Basically.
I mean, just unbelievably complex thing to do, and I mean, the interesting thing is that in the March 1943 is the first time they start putting out 60 ship convoys. Normally they're 40. So. Convoys are divided into two classes. They're either fast or they're slow. But right. Fast is not fast. It's an average of 9 knots, an expectation of 9 knots averaged across the Atlantic, which makes it a very, you know, that's like a 16-17 day voyage. Eastbound convoys, HX, coded HX from Halifax, they're HX if they're fast, and they're SC, Sydney, Cape Breton in Canada, if they're slow. So that's how you know just by the code name whether it's a fast convoy or a slow convoy. If it's westbound, it's ON if it's fast, and it's ONS if it's slow. And by the end of March 1943, fast convoys are sailing every 6 days. and slow ones every 8 days. I mean, that is just an incredible amount, isn't it?
Well, you're just thinking about the... I mean, before they even put to sea, the pressure on the docks and the stividors,
yeah,
and how you organise that loading, and then you've got the yep. next convoy queuing or in a stacking pattern or whatever, or anchored off and needing to be protected. I mean, the sheer scale of it, because obviously modern shipping...
absolutely makes your head hurt, doesn't it?
Well, because modern trade shipping that we have now, you know, they're not in convoys, so they come in one by one and be dealt, or however. It's the fact that you have a load of ships all turning up at once that need your attention.
But just imagine what 60 ships looks like going out to sea and trying to form up into a rectangle. And the interesting thing about the 60 is that, so basically convoys are formed that they're wide rather than deep, so they're kind of what they 6 miles wide. A 60 ship convoy is 6 miles wide, and it's each ship has a number, and it might not be 1 to 60, it might be whatever, you know, it might be 1 to 1, it might be 1 4 3, it might be 28, but anyway, you're given a number, and that number is put into a position, and there would be say 14 columns of five or whatever to in a convoy of 60, something like that, between 4 and 5. And they would all be 2,000 yards. The columns would be 2,000 yards apart and maybe, you know, what is it, 400 yards in between, you know, astern, 1, 2, 3, and 5 in the line. So you might be column 12, ship 3. That means you're the from north to south, you are the 13th column, and you are third in the line from the front. So that's how that works. And Professor Pratchett Blackett, great friend of the show, who is the head of Naval Operation Research, who invents the Blackett site and all the rest of it, he's the guy who backs Barnes-Wallis for the dams rate. He's when the Navy get in early before the RAF do. And he makes the point that actually increasing the convoys by 20 is actually much more efficient, because it doesn't massively increase the perimeter size of the... It doesn't need to massively increase the perimeter size. Doesn't make it that much harder for an escort of 8 vessels to look after them for 60, whether it's 60 or 40. And there's lots of sort of harumphing from the Admiralty, but actually they then agree. And of course, that just does make a big difference, because you've got the more of you there are, the more are going to get through. Yeah, you know, it's as simple as that.
Well, and also the more pairs of eyes there are, and the more the
all that. Yeah. And even merchant ships have some protection. I mean, they have sort of, you know, Oerlikons on them and all the rest of it, and flares, and you know, and so on and so forth. So you know, it does mean a greater pressure on Liverpool and Greenock and Gurrook and all these kind of places, and Nova Scotia and Halifax, Nova Scotia, but. It does make the chances of getting through greater. There's no question about it.
Which is interesting.
So that's how convoys set up.
Well, that in a way kind of also feels kind of counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because it feels like a bigger, juicier target for wolf packs, doesn't it? That you're serving up more ships for the Germans to attack. You can see why. If you know the counterintuition is that surely ships on their own going as fast as they possibly can are better off, which is where the thinking starts, isn't it? Convoys are seen as a kind of last resort, aren't they? Going into convoy is seen as a, oh, we're going to have to do that again. And then perfecting it is seen as a, you know, like you say, the people are dragging their heels about how best to do it. Because I think you end up going at 3 knots all the way across the Atlantic. And that feels like, and with 60 ships, that feels like a great big fat juicy target, doesn't it? That must feel very, on one level, very vulnerable.
Slow convoys are going at, they're no more than 40. In size rather than 60. It's only the fast ones in inverted commas are 60 ship convoys, where they are going, you know, they're going aiming to go at least 9. And obviously the average speed of the convoy depends on the makeup of the convoy. As you say, you've always got to go at the pace of the slowest.
You know, if you're a wolf pack and so I mean, we're going to get to the U-boat situation in a second. If you're a wolf pack, surely what you do is pick off the destroyers, Jim. And then you can sink the convoy at your leisure. But however,
that is, however, yes, go on.
Well, well, that's not their mindset, which I find
absolutely extraordinary. They just don't spend enough time focusing on the escorts. So you'd have thought the first thing you should do is destroy the escorts, and they just don't. They never do. It's never their tactics. Yeah. You know, escorts are much, much harder to hit, of course, because they're not going straight and steady in a single line. You know, they're moving around all over the place. But even so, it makes much more sense to get rid of the escorts. Then you can do what you like, as you say.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Genius of the Germans in the Second World War.
Well, so the Germans have 116 U-boats.
Operating in the Atlantic at this point. They've got about 300 by this stage. They've got about 300 by this stage. And, you know, you're based on the third. So a third going to and forth, a third kind of training and re-equipping and all the rest of it and building up, and a third actually in combat. That's the kind of rule of thumb. And it's not far off it. But of course, by this stage, you know, they've got these, because the U-boat arm was only 3,000 men strong in 1939, it's very difficult to massively expand when you're also at the same time taking really critical losses. And you know, one of the reasons why the spring of 1941 is so crucial in the Atlantic War is because so many of the aces, the U-boat aces, get lost. And by, I mentioned at the beginning, kind of sort of, you know, Kretschmer, Shepka and Preen, all three go in, two of them are killed, one of them taken prisoner between March and May 1941. And you know, this experience, these are guys who've been in submarines since, you know, the 1930s. They're absolutely, you know, totally what they're about. They're incredibly skilled, highly trained, highly competent, bit older, got all that kind of sort of gravitas and authority and all the rest of it. And they're just gone. And by 1943, there is literally no one of any significant repute still operating in the U-boat arm by this stage, because even those that have survived, like Eric Topp, Teddy Suren, these kind of types, they're now very sensibly on training rather than risking their lives out in the Atlantic. What that means is you've got way, way, way more U-boats than you had in 1940 and 1941, but you haven't got that depth of experience. And that's the problem about having the U-boat arm being so small in 1939, is that when you do need to suddenly expand, you haven't got that weight of manpower to be able to spread through and take on the, you know, and lead with the next generation as it's rapidly expanding. So they're having to kind of sort of work on this sort of on the hoof with insufficient training, insufficient experience, and crucially, U-boat captains are being promoted as Oberleutnant, you know, first lieutenant, way before they should be, because pressure of numbers and all the rest of it. And
yeah, they're out of people.
And so it's ever decreasing circles. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, what's their sort of culture from the First World War? Because after all, you know, the U-boat campaign in the First World War was, again, very effective and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it works and it's actually the one thing you've got that could, you know, that could on a tactical level to deliver a strategic result. So it seems they must know this. So it's strange, really, that they haven't invested so heavily in it that they ought to have done. I mean, it is peculiar, isn't it? And again, what this will come round to is this is the problem is you've got Hitler, whose mentality is he needs big, showy battleships to show the public that rearmament's happening, and to do things
exactly
in the sort of he's got to do things in this the PR
is a Z plan of. Yeah.
That so much the rearmament is about PR and is about presenting a thing to people. And submarines don't offer you that. Also, if you build a load of submarines,
I reckon 50 U-boats all lined up in harbour would look pretty powwow. Particularly when everyone knows how successful the U-boats were in the last war.
Yes, but then as a result, and then but of course you're then signalling your intentions to your potential enemies. And if you're building lots of U-boats, you obviously want to fight the British, don't you? Because they're the world's preeminent maritime power. So you build a load of U-boats, you rather give the game away that you're considering fighting the British Empire.
Absolutely.
And signalling your intentions to the other side. And Hitler's intention isn't to fight necessarily the British. It's to.
Well, not in the 1930s, it isn't, no.
Not in the 1930s, it isn't, anyway. Exactly, which is when these things are getting laid down. Whereas the British, for all their sort of all their sort of pussyfooting about it, they know perfectly well they're going to end up fighting the Germans next, if they're going to fight anybody. So in a peculiar way, there's
they're building lots of destroyers.
Exactly. So there's a, you know, end up with a cavity magnetron and all that sort of thing. So for all the British humming and ahhing about fighting the Germans, it's the Germans whose indecision in the 19th, lack of intent. I mean, this is a direct flip of the appeasement story, isn't it? So Germans can't make their mind up about who they're going to fight, and that's what that's the thing they're reaping right at this moment. Whereas the British, who've always thought in the end we're going to have to fight a maritime war because we're a maritime power.
Absolutely.
Isn't that as an interesting? It's a funny we've ended up with. We go. That's another.
No, a little rabbit hole. We've done.
We flipped that fried egg over. Right. Okay. So.
That's the situation. Beginning in 1940. Yeah. Beginning in 1943. There's lots of U-boats, but they're not very skilled. It's basically the long and short.
And how do they operate? Because this is the thing that Gretton's book I was really struck by, and the method that the destroyers have is they figure out that the Wolfpack, they have to ask permission to engage the U-boats, so they essentially report back to the lead boat. Control. Ich habe dieses Destroyer.
It's not even lead boats. It's control back at sort of, you know,
Northern France.
Lorient or whatever.
Which is extraordinary, because that doesn't sound much like Alpha Tactique to me. If what you're having to do,
and that's also a reflection of
the collapse
less,
in experience,
confidence. Yeah. But really, it's about it's not so much that. It's more about coordinating a wolf pack. So what Dönitz is doing by the spring of 1943 is wolf packs used to be kind of, sort of half a dozen. By now they're kind of formed into groups of 20. 20 is considered pretty much the optimum, because after a while it gets sort of too unwieldy and too complicated. But what that means is you've got to actually be quite careful about how you do this. So what would generally happen is the Germans get wind of a convoy sailing, so they know it's coming. They know kind of roughly what the route is. So what you would do is you would then get your U-boats into a kind of massive line, say your 20, each sort of, you know, where the total line is about 280 miles, something like that, or 300 miles or 250 miles, but a big old stretch, and you would advance towards where you think the convoy is likely to be. And then the moment one of them sees it, spots the convoy, they are then the contact keeper, and all the other U-boats then home towards it. It's like, right, I've got it. It seems to be moving on a bearing of 045 degrees. You know, I've got it in my sights. And the idea is to try and let the convoy come onto you so you can attack it from the front, so that you get into the right position using your surface speed, but then you attack it from under the surface as it's coming towards you. That's basically the idea. But what that means is the person who makes a contact has to signal that contact, and signals back to control BDU, the headquarters of the U-boat arm, and says, you know, well, I've got this, I found the convoy, this is where it is. And then it is control that is feeding the signals back to the other U-boats and saying, right, this is where the convoy is, you know, head on this bearing X and off you go. But the contact keeper is not, as you rightly point out, is not allowed to make any contact. It is not allowed to attack until given permission to do so. And that's because they don't want to kind of to attack prematurely and make the convoy scatter or change just before all the 20 have homed in on it. That's the main reason.
What's very interesting is in the official, the authorised GCHQ history, John Ferris talks about how it's really, really interesting. He says that the German SIGINT at this point is so good locating convoys and discovering Allied intentions that actually what it does is it makes them make terrible operational decisions. He says, because German intelligence success lured Germans into operational failures. So he says because they're able to do what we're just talking about, because they can figure out how to engage convoys, they actually send themselves into engaging convoys, and then the Allies overpower them. He says the Germans in the Atlantic are relying purely on their intelligence to conduct the campaign, whereas the British are relying on their operational, industrial, technological and intelligence capability to fight the campaign. Germans only bring one thing to the party. They will be overwhelmed and destroyed. And then he talks about, but by the end of it, the British are deliberately sailing convoys onto the U-boats to draw them into battle to destroy them. Because once they've got the thing figured out, they tell the B-dienst where they are. And they're reading the B-dienst as well. They're reading what the Germans think is happening. But no, obviously March 43, they're blind at this point. But by the time it flips, the German operational German superiority with intelligence leads them into operational disaster, which I think is an amazing way of looking at it.
Fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating.
Well, so from the British point of view, there's basically sort of three electronic means of detection. There's obviously radar, onboard radar, which most of them have by this stage. There's HFDF, high frequency direction finding, which is sort of picking up radio signals, and then of course there's ASDIC, which we now know as sonar. So HFDF is really interesting. Most of the escorts are normally equipped with HFDF, not always, but most of them are. And that enables them to pick up these sort of any radio signals that the U-boats, and from where it is, you can pick it up, and the kind of that enables them to pinpoint pretty much where the U-boat is that has sent that signal. And the Admiralty also and get a bearing from it. And the Admiralty also has a series of shore-based HFDF stations, high frequency direction finding stations. And these are scattered through kind of Iceland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, the Azores, and so on. And a massive information is coming in, and this is analysed. In the Admiralty tracking room in London, and this is it's also other intelligence is coming in as well, so anecdotal from agents from Bletchley Park, all rest of it, and it's a bit like the kind of filter room or the control room at kind of Benley Priory for Fighter Command. All this material's coming in, and it has to be analysed and then sort of regurgitated. And by this point, also most, in fact, all ocean-going escorts, even the kind of corvettes and frigates, which are the kind of smaller escorts, have the new centimetric radars, which I think is a Type 247, which means that they can detect U-boats out further than before on a calm sea, about 4 miles, something like that. But
well, he says the ASDIC's 2,000 meters, isn't it? Basically,
on good weather,
and again, we come back to that. There's a level playing field if the weather's all right, but if it isn't, it's very advantageous to the U-boats. So the perimeter of a
60 ship convoy is 60 miles, which is a hell of a distance. Really 8 escort ships. I mean, you can do it with 6, but 8 escort ships is the kind of minimum you want. The problem is because of the shipping shortage, by March 1943, there aren't enough fast destroyers to do what you want to do. There's been losses, they're still making more and the rest of it. But what they're really trying to do is build bulk and build numbers so that you've got enough escorts for these, convoys every 6 days and every 8 days. So what that actually means is that every 8 days you've got 2 transatlantic convoys going across, which is a hell of a lot, all of which need escorting. So the way around this is to build smaller boats because they're cheaper and easier and quicker to build than destroyers. And destroyers, if you think a destroyer is sort of 90 to 120 meters in length, that kind of scale, a corvette is like 60, 65. Yeah. So it's a similar sort of length to a landing ship tank, the LCT, outside the museum in Portsmouth, for example. Frigates are a bit bigger. They're more like kind of 80. But they're pretty small. An HX-231 has only got 6, of which one is a destroyer, one is a frigate, 4 a corvette. You'd have one ship at the front in the bow, out front. Then you'd have 2 on the kind of sort of port and starboard side. Then on the 2 on the beam, and then you'd have 1 at the back. And your fastest ship would always be the one at the back, because that's the one you need to go off and do sweeps if something's gone missing, or ships dropped out, or that you said your fastest one, because it's the ablest to get back to the rest of the convoy quickest.
We should pause here until our next episode.
It's going to be 3, isn't it?
It's going to be 3. When we will look at the convoy HX-231 and what happens in late March into April 1943. I don't want to give anything away.
I don't want to give any away, but it's an amazing story. And
it is an extraordinary
story. I really think it's worth doing this in some detail because it is so interesting how these things work. There's so many aspects about these convoys and about the escorts and about the U-boats and about how they operated that one simply just doesn't know. And so to have this kind of spelt out, I think, is with one example, I think is a really, really useful exercise.
Leave New York at 0850 hours.
Yep.
On the 25th of March. What happens next? We'll see you next week. We hope you're on the edge of your seats the way we are about HX231 and what's to come. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.